And articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading some articles from the August-September issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Edgeworth Security. When you need protection and peace of mind, Ken Young's company has the Advanced Solutions, by Lindsay Welchel. Imagine that someone with bad intentions is casing your property. A shadowy figure hovers around your fence line, deciding whether to try to get in. That's when a voice comes over a loudspeaker advising the individual to retreat. Someone is watching every move the prospective intruder makes and has your property protectively surrounded. Meet Edgeworth Security. Combine innovative technology similar to what you might expect to see in a spy movie with the watchful eyes of a live human being, and you've got the recipe for a well-protected property and family. That's the premise behind the Pittsburgh-based security company. Edgeworth offers nationwide bespoke security solutions optimized to reduce cost to clients ranging from commercial properties, multifamily dwellings, and construction sites, to high-dollar estates and ranches, as well as celebrities and executives and their families. At the helm of Edgeworth Security are Ken Young, Chief Executive Officer, and Holly Schenck, Chief Operating Officer. Prior to their current roles, Young spent over 21 years as a U.S. Marine in elite units, even protecting the executive branch of the United States, working Marine One security detail, and as an emergency action planner under President George W. Bush. In 2015, he began his career in private security. This path would lead him to co-founding Edgeworth. Schenck spent her career implementing smart technology and artificial intelligence for highly secure government clients in the intelligence sector before being presented with the opportunity she feels her career had been preparing her for at Edgeworth. The backgrounds of Young and Schenck, not coincidentally, mirror the foundation of Edgeworth as a whole. The company's multifaceted security solutions range from advanced state-of-the-art technology, think artificial intelligence and smart cameras, to real-time physical and virtual human-led protection. The goal? To stop threats that range from trespassing and theft to attacks on someone's physical safety or online information. When Young began his career in security protection after serving in the military, one of his first clients was Thomas Tull. A prominent businessman, Young was tasked with evaluating ways to improve Tull's security while reducing the overall yearly spending he was devoting to live guards at properties he and his family weren't even inhabiting. Young began to scour technology trade shows looking for solutions. My main task was to figure out how to protect assets in an equally good way, but at a lower operational cost. What we ultimately ended up doing was putting cameras with enhanced analytics around the perimeters of the property where there was no threat to life or limb and feeding it back to the place where the agents were, where the family currently was, and using analytically triggered alarms to monitor and protect. Edgeworth Security emerged from this arrangement. In fact, Tull believed in it so much he provided the funding to help bolster the company. I strongly believe that utilizing enhanced analytics is the key to effectively offsetting security costs, Tull says. The ability to leverage data-driven insights not only strengthens security measures, but also optimizes resource allocation. This conviction is what has made me investing heavily in the company. I am confident in its potential to revolutionize the industry through its cutting-edge analytics technology. Edgeworth quickly began to grow, amassing clients and staff for its efforts. Today, their leadership branch has over 100 plus years of combined military experience. There's an entire remote monitoring center with staff who provide perimeter guarding via smart cameras and speakers to a wide range of clients. When a threat is detected, the staff are notified. They evaluate the situation and voice down to the threat to deter trouble. If needed, they can also notify law enforcement. What sets Edgeworth apart from traditional security systems is that typical sensor-based alarms only detect a threat once it's inside your property. Edgeworth monitors your perimeter. Additionally, because its video surveillance can verify a threat, law enforcement can respond effectively. Given police staffing and funding issues, Young says, a traditional sensor-based system can complicate or delay getting a quick response. The benefits of implementing Edgeworth extend beyond optimized security. It can also be a smart financial and business decision. Commercial clients, for instance, can leverage their security as a benefit to tenants. Private clients, such as those with valuable items like one-of-a-kind art collections, might need a more sophisticated security system to be able to insure their property with insurance companies. In addition to its perimeter video monitoring, Edgeworth is expanding and offering solutions to meet individual clients' needs. The company recently acquired an executive protection company to be able to offer a hybrid solution of in-person guarding when and where it is needed. The company also has grown its open source intelligence division, which monitors clients' online security by sifting through thousands of pieces of digital information to identify threats and cybersecurity weaknesses, especially on the dark web. It's this provocative approach that resonates with Schenck after her years of experience working in government, where red tape sometimes complicated security solutions. The commercial ability to actually leverage security tools without hurdles has been very refreshing, Schenck says. You can provide people the things they're looking for. You can amplify the security investments that they've made by adding on technology, adding on physical guards. Edgeworth really can create the most efficient picture for the customer, which is just the dream. Knowing they're doing a real service to their clients makes the work rewarding for both Schenck and Young. It's also baked into the employees, who take that service mentality to heart. Whether it's the attention to detail required of technicians installing the equipment on high-dollar structures, the monitoring center employees with a dedication and curiosity to investigate anything that seems out of place, or protectors in the field with a real passion to stand guard over their clients without distraction, the team at Edgeworth embraces the mission of the company. The dedication has earned many pleased customers, including a very familiar name, Josh Brolin. The star of Outer Range, No Country for Old Men, and W, Brolin utilizes Edgeworth at his ranch in Malibu, California. He had initially been reluctant to implement a security system, but he no doubt became a customer for life when one of Edgeworth's employees alerted him to a coyote in his backyard moments before he let his children go out to play. "When they called me that fast, I was very moved by it," Brolin says. "It was like, wow, you guys are actually taking this personally. You guys are very good at your jobs, and I love that because, especially in this day and age, I see people less and less have that work ethic. That old school grit doesn't seem to exist anymore. When I saw how much integrity they had around their business and how personal they made it, it makes it more comfortable for me." Young reinforces the sentiment. "We don't advertise that we protect your property from coyotes," he says with a laugh. That is not our service contract. But our service doesn't just stop at our contract, because our employees care so much about our clients that they go above and beyond. And that's more than protection. That's peace of mind. New Mexico magic. Here, where the old world and the Wild West meld magically, it's always the land of enchantment. But New Mexico is especially enchanting, and the city different is wonderfully so in August during Santa Fe Indian Market. By Wolf Schneider. Santa Fe Indian Market 101 arrives in August with artists, fashions, and fry bread. Close to 1,000 artists from more than 200 indigenous nations in the U.S. and Canada. New fashion designers, among them On the Rise Montana beater Elias Not Afraid, Absoluki, a new diamond experience, ticket for VIP seating at Sunday's Indigenous Fashion Show, a fresh tagline, the first year of the next century, a new executive director, Jamie Schultz, who's Northern Cheyenne, Sisseton Wahpeton, Oyate, and a later opening time, 9 a.m. That's what to expect as Santa Fe Indian Market rolls into its 101st year on August 1920. And, oh yeah, gonna be turquoise everywhere. The action gets underway on Wednesday, August 16th, when artists arrive at the art receiving station. Thursday is for official judging. Come Friday, winners are announced at the Best of Show ceremony. On Saturday and Sunday, it's the grand affair. Look for 650 booths, with 30% of the artists being newcomers in 2023. They'll be offering up jewelry, pottery, paintings, sculpture, beadwork, photography, and more. Bringing the glam, the gala live auction, fashion shows, art auction and thought panels, and the surge in lapis, sugalite, and opal stones. It's all part of Indian Market, the largest juried Native American art market in the world. It attracts some 100,000 visitors annually, with Ally McGraw, Tom Ford, Robert Redford, Wes Studi, and Diane Keaton sometimes among them. Lives can change at Indian Market. Fine art photographer Cara Romero, Chimahueve, landed her first major museum acquisition there when artist Tony Abeta, Navajo, brought a curator from the Smithsonian Museum of the American Indian to her booth. In 2021, Romero was again at her booth when U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland, Laguna Pueblo, came by. I got a selfie with Deb, Romero recalls. That was probably one of the most exciting people who ever came by. Romero's favorite thing to see at the market? The Best of Show preview on Friday night. To do? Purchase something from an emerging artist and an elder every year. To eat? Lamb fry bread tacos with green chili. Last year, Romero became a Best of Class winner. So did jeweler Ernest Benally, Navajo. They called me Thursday afternoon and told me to come to the Best of Show luncheon and not to tell anybody. It's like a big secret. Don't tell anybody you won, he remembers. He only told his kids. Want to have lunch in Santa Fe? His favorite thing to do at market? Do sales and meet the customers. To eat? Something from the French pastry shop. And dinner at Tomasitas. Glenda McKay, Ingalik Athabascan, won Best of Class last year, too, for her traditional harpoon. She loves when the artists set up at dawn before the show opens and everyone goes around to see everyone's things first, before anybody else. Potter Russell Sanchez, San Ildefonso Pueblo, won the big award last year, Best of Show. Even before that, when he would show up to unload his pots on Saturday at 6 a.m., there would already be a line waiting at his booth. I get a lot of calls before market. To be fair, I tell them to get there early and get on my sign-up list. He usually sells out within an hour of opening. For dinner that night, you may spot him at Geronimo or The Shed with one of his collectors. In the Bunkhouse with Red Steagall, the official cowboy poet of Texas. For much of the life of this magazine, this page has featured Red Steagall's insightful conversations with cowboys, cowgirls, historians, entertainers, rodeo icons, and more. This column is one part of Red's expansive contributions to poetry, music, media, and the Western ethos at large. When Red took the stage at the 2023 Western Heritage Awards to accept this year's Lifetime Achievement Award, he gave a stirring speech about his life and his role in keeping Western traditions alive. To honor our longtime columnist and his message, we'd like to share some excerpts from that speech with you. Enjoy his words, and we'll see you back here next issue with more of Red's Bunkhouse Conversations. A Village of Partners. You know, sometimes early in life, you choose what you want to do with your life, and you don't have any idea how it's going to turn out. It has peaks and valleys. One day you discover that you're really on the right track and you put everything you have into it to make it work. That happened to me a couple of times. A couple of times it didn't work, but I am the most blessed human being on the face of this earth because I've been able to do exactly what I wanted to do, the way I wanted to do it my entire life. And I can't accept this for me. Every single part of it has had partners all my life. What would Mother do? My parents, especially my dear, dear mother, made me believe I could accomplish anything I wanted to. She had six kids, and every one of us thought we were her favorite. And the most important thing she did for all of us was teach us to talk and spell properly. She believed that was one of the main things that developed confidence in a person. So as life has gone on, I can't tell you how many times I stopped during the day to say, would Mother approve of that? Even at 84 years of age, I still think about how she would look at it, whether she would approve of it. A lifetime of love. There's a lady that is definitely the love of my life. My entire world revolves around Gail. We've been married for 46 years, but we've been best friends for about 56 years, and she determines every single attitude I have. She's my best friend. She's my life mate. She's my soul mate, and I love her with all my heart and soul. His Corner of the West. Sean Struder's here, representing our radio show, Cowboy Corner. And I want to thank my friends at RFD-TV and the Cowboy Channel and partner Greg Brown on behalf of the Somewhere West of Wall Street show. We've been on the air with Cowboy Corner for 30 years across this great nation, talking to people about the Western way of life, doing cowboy poetry, playing songs, and talking about the West. And all those musicians that have recorded with me all through these years and traveled with me on the road. For about 20 years, we were on the road 250 days a year. It's a tough life, but we didn't know that when we were young. We thought we were carpenters. We had to have a saw and a hammer. That translates to a band and a bus. On the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum. This museum, this unbelievable institution that preserves our history and our heritage and our traditions, helps us understand the values that we live by. This is bricks and mortar and wood, the people who provide the inspiration for the art that keeps the image of the West alive. Nobody does it better than the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum and Hall of Fame. Letter Buck. September in this eastern Oregon town means one all-encompassing thing, the Pendleton Roundup. Photos and text by Bo Simmons. Backcountry roads lead to quiet prairies filled with ranch homes, grain silos, and abandoned farms scattered all along the outskirts of Pendleton, Oregon. Don't let the quiet fool you. Every September, the second full week to be exact, this town of just over 17,000, tucked in a valley of rolling hills and wheat fields, sees more than 50,000 people descend for one of the most action-packed and time-honored events in rodeo and in the West, the Pendleton Roundup. Founded in 1910, it's bucking stronger than ever. When you experience it, you realize just how much the motto, "Letter Buck," really means. The community and schools shut down for rodeo week, since the kids and families are volunteering for the event. In the downtown, streets close down and transform into pop-up shops, food booths, carnival rides, and many concert venues with stages set up right in the road. Last year was my first time attending the Roundup, which is one of the last big benchmarks for rodeo athletes to attain a spot at the National Finals Rodeo. I have photographed quite a few rodeos in my career, but I haven't been to one as exciting or as authentic as Pendleton. I knew there would be people visiting from all over the world, but I had no idea just how much energy would surround not only the rodeo grounds, but the entire town. Every restaurant and local vendor had it on television. Every street felt not like an opportunity to drive, but an opportunity to do, eat, drink, shop, dance. If you somehow arrive during Roundup week without the appropriate gear, hat, boots, fringe, and feel sartorially out of step, there are plenty of vendors who can fix that right up with some serious Western flair to add to your look. Pendleton Hat Company is the go-to cowboy hat shop, and you can have Perkins custom shape your crown to your own personal style. My days in Pendleton were packed full. There was so much to do and see. I toured the underground card rooms that thrived in the early 1900s when the town had 32 of them, along with bars and 18 brothels. The action was largely underground in a series of tunnels and private rooms to keep things undercover. Pendleton Whiskey, a brand of Canadian whiskey that is distilled in Canada and bottled using water from Mount Hood, about 150 miles west of here in Hood River, Oregon, was plentifully on hand, and I availed myself of tastings of its whiskey selections. Personal favorites, Pendleton Midnight and Pendleton Rye 1910, which, like all of its bottles, honor the Western heritage and traditions of Pendleton with the Roundup's iconic bucking horse image. And I gorged myself at two of the best steakhouses, Virgil's at Cineotti's and Hamley's. In between touring the town and photographing at the rodeo grounds, I drove around exploring the surrounding valley, meeting local folks eager to share stories about Pendleton and its famous Roundup. Happily, I managed to fit in a stop for lunch at OMG Burgers and Brew, and I can remember firsthand the PBJJ, peanut butter, raspberry jam, fresh jalapenos, add bacon and cheese curds, and deep-fried spicy pickle fries. And naturally, I couldn't travel all this way without taking a tour of Pendleton Woolen Mills, which has been in the blanket business since 1909, making it even older than the Roundup. Here you'll discover the British weaver Thomas Kay laid the foundation for the company when he arrived in Oregon in 1863. His grandsons, the three Bishop brothers, would go on to open Pendleton Woolen Mills, and Kay's textile expertise would live on in Pendleton's tweed, flannel, and worsted wool. I knew going into this event-filled week, I wanted to capture the authenticity of this famous rodeo. There are thousands of action shots focusing on the rodeo itself, but I wanted to spend more time documenting the athletes, the lifestyle surrounding the town, the local scenery, and the people who are involved. I wanted images that would honor the people I photographed and that would let the viewer take a closer look at what happens behind the crazy times at the Pendleton Roundup. What attracted me most, visually, were the energy of the town and the emotion on everyone's faces. Everyone there, including visitors, had come from all over the world for 1 week filled with amazing experiences. My job was to capture that essence as accurately as possible while celebrating those who partake in this rodeo every single year. Some of the photos that stood out to me the most were the rodeo athletes getting ready, the queen and court, and the portraits of Native Americans at Indian Village. When I showed up to photograph them, the rodeo athletes were sitting around on rusted chairs, taping up their arms, hands, and knees with athletic tape, and sharing laughs and stories about previous rodeos and events they all had traveled from. After spending some time behind the chutes and documenting the action, I wanted to slow things down and highlight the queen and court. This rodeo has started various movements in the rodeo world, including the concept of a rodeo queen, dating back to the event's founding in 1910. I was able to sit down with the ladies and shoot portraits of each separately before getting one final image of all of them together. Seeing the joy on little girls' faces as they got the chance to meet the queen and court was special. Later, while walking around Indian Village, I was fortunate to meet a few Native Americans and make their portraits. Each year, more than 300 teepees are set up within the Indian Village, offering visitors the chance to not only support indigenous vendors who sell handcrafted gifts, jewelry, and beadwork, but also to surround themselves with the culture and history of these indigenous nations. After photographing a few men and women in full regalia, I witnessed the powerful Happy Canyon pageant in the arena during the rodeo matinees. Luckily, even after I left Pendleton, the phenomenal experience didn't end. There were photos to look at, Pendleton whiskey to drink, and Pendleton blankets that I FedExed home to wrap up in. And, of course, there was this year's roundup to look forward to. New Mexico is ancient and atomic, desolate and deluxe. Its profound contrasts are just some of the alluring things that make it the land of extreme enchantments. By Mac Crossman. 5 minutes into my hike at White Sands, I stopped to look around. In every direction of this national monument in southeast New Mexico, there was nothing but white, white, white. Endless, rolling hills of it. I was standing in the largest field of white gypsum in the world, and I was consumed by it already, as if it were literally endless and not just seemingly so. I knew my car was just over there, not even a quarter mile over that ridge, but it might as well have been in another world away. I adjusted my backpack, marveled at the crisp horizon, the blue of the sky deeper and richer because of the white below it, and followed the trail to my campsite, one of only 10 in the 275 square miles at White Sands. In the next 12 hours, I would see only two people. One of them was a 20-something woman who had arrived at the trailhead at the same time I did. We hiked in together. She told me she was killing time, traveling around the West, Kerouac, with an ankle tat and an Instagram account. By contrast, I drove in from a professional work conference where I'd spent the last few days networking and making important connections with potential clients to grow my business. I had a sport coat hanging in my car and a carefully planned itinerary in my computer bag. She looked free, free from worry, obligation, responsibility, even free from shoes. The sand, warmed by the 70-degree day, must have felt soft and pleasant under her feet. I wanted to take my boots off. I double-knotted them instead. We were like characters in a bad coming-of-age movie, where I would teach her responsibility, and she would teach me to lighten the hell up. Starting with the contrast between us, I would learn over and over again in the next few days that New Mexico is a place of extremes. My friend Andy and I would drift peacefully up, up, up in a hot air balloon worth five figures, if not more, and zip maniacally down, down, down the dunes at White Sands in a plastic sled worth single figures, if not less. We would elbow for space in a crowded tram high atop Sandia Peak and stand alone at the bottom of deep desert canyons. We would sleep in the mega thread count sheets at the luxurious Hotel Chaco in bustling Albuquerque, and on the hard ground in Barron Bandelier National Monument. New Mexico, we discovered, isn't just the land of enchantment, it's the land of extreme enchantments. I said goodbye to my new hippie friend, set up my tent in the shadow of a dune, and climbed to the top as the sun crept toward the horizon. I looked east, toward a butte. Horizontal striations made it look like a layer cake. Brown and then yellow and then brown and then yellow and then brown again. Then the ridge stopped and the sky began. There are more striations there. Purple, then red, then orange, then blue. I spun around and faced west, where the sun had just set. The ridge there was backlit. Black and impenetrable, striations hidden. It was 6:36 p.m. The sun had been behind the ridge for 10 minutes, and the temperature had dropped 10 degrees already. I walked down to my tent to grab my coat. As I descended the hill, the cold air squeezed my chest like a too small t-shirt. I walked back up, and when I reached the top, the sand radiated heat like an open oven. Slowly, the world turned black and white. Tucked inside my sleeping bag with a winter hat protecting my head, I looked up at the lights of the universe. A shooting star shot across my vision for so long that I turned my head to watch it go. It disappeared behind my tent. I turned my gaze from infinity to the present, where a copy of Frankenstein was alight in my Kindle. The book begins and ends with Victor Frankenstein chasing his monster across a vast, frozen, desolate landscape, not unlike where I was at the moment. Not 60 miles from here, the Manhattan Project birthed its own monstrous achievement. On July 16, 1945, 1 week after White Sands missile range was established, the first atomic bomb was detonated. A mushroom cloud blossomed almost 40,000 feet up. At ground zero on the Trinity nuke test, the blast turned sand into glass-like substance the color of green jade. They variously dubbed it Trinitite, Atomsite, Alamogordo glass. It's not on this trip's itinerary, but we could have gone to the White Sands Missile Range Museum on the 3,200-square-mile military installation. Better to let that explosive history fade with the absolute silence that swallowed me. There was no wind, and no trees for it to rustle anyway. No animal footsteps, no highway, no sounds of civilization at all. I drifted off. An hour or so later, a jet landing at a nearby base shattered the silence and shook the very earth itself. Remember the carefully crafted itinerary I mentioned? Well, man plans, New Mexico laughs. A freak October snowfall cost Andy and me one of the nights we planned to spend at Bandelier. Instead of camping out, we spent the night at Hotel Chaco. Instead of a rigorous morning hike, we went for a hot air balloon ride. Both of those last-minute adjustments provided proof, if any was needed, that you won't run out of things to do in New Mexico. Only time to do them. We arrived at Rainbow Riders, by far the largest hot air balloon ride provider in the state, at 6:45 a.m., and the waiting room was already full. "Is this everybody's first time in a balloon?" asked our pilot, Damien. "Me too," he joked. "So we're going to figure it out together. I just have to watch one more YouTube video. Something about landing." A hot air balloon ride doesn't fit neatly into a rigid schedule. In most other adventures, you know when you'll start, when you'll end, and where you'll be when you're done. With a hot air balloon, you get only the first of those three. The rest is up to the wind. Soon we were aloft in a balloon named Roadrunner. The only noise was the occasional burst from the burner, which shot flames into the 225,000 cubic foot balloon to heat the air to 160 degrees. The nine of us aboard, seven passengers, Damien and his co-pilot, talked sparingly as we were too consumed by the vast and soaring sense of forever up there to bother with small talk. In front of us, the sun climbed into the sky behind Sandia Peak. Below us, the Rio Grande cut a dull brown-green trail through bright yellow cottonwoods. When we floated over the river, a chill reached us even from a few thousand feet above it. We drifted at the whim of the wind, as free as the woman I met at White Sands. After an hour, Damien looked for a place to land as we cruised low over a subdivision. I hollered to a woman taking pictures of us from below, "Text that to me," and she laughed. The noise from the burner apparently drives dogs nuts as barks reached us from every direction. A few minutes later, we touched down softly in a field. I follow a simple rule when traveling. Always eat breakfast at a restaurant named after a woman. So when Damien recommended Mary and Tito's, I said yes before knowing anything else. It looks like a mom-and-pop greasy spoon, and it is, but it's also a renowned James Beard Award winner. When we walked in, a customer greeted us, offered suggestions on what to eat, and pointed us to where to sit. I asked how he knew we had never been there, and he said regulars have a certain look, a been there, ate that, back for more grin that Andy and I lacked. We stuffed ourselves with carne adobo, and at a customer's suggestion, asked for the homemade Mexican wedding cake. The waiter doubted they had any left. When he announced some was available, others in the restaurant said we could count ourselves blessed. After one bite, we did. The snow melted at Bandelier, so we jumped in the car and headed there. A gorgeous drive that deserves more than this parenthetical. Hiked for a couple of hours and camped on the lip of Alamo Canyon. Imagine a hard-packed, rocky desert. Now imagine God pulled out a chainsaw worthy of him, sliced that desert open, and bid you to not just look inside, but to scramble down there. How are we going to get down there and then back up on the other side? Slowly is the best answer. Small steps, carefully placed. We inched our way along, stopping frequently to gape at the beauty, catch our breath, or both. One side was in shadow and cold. One side was in the sun and radiated heat. Temperature-wise, it was like day turned to night, turned back to day, depending on where you were. Everywhere I travel, they say, if you don't like the weather, wait for a few minutes. In New Mexico, if you don't like the weather, move a few feet. We arrived at the top, and the vertical trail became horizontal, unfolding long and flat before us. Modern Americans would not want to live here. Wild temperature swings, barren landscape, and lack of water don't appeal to our sensibilities. The Alamo Canyon and nearby Capulin Canyon, though breathtakingly beautiful, make getting in and out impractical. But Bandelier is full of ancient sites. The ancestral Pueblos arrived here 870 years ago, roughly in 1150. It's not clear what happened, but they abandoned the area after 400 years. They left behind incalculable treasures for archaeologists, from remnants of Pueblos to cavates, human-carved alcoves, to pictographs, to shards of tools. The trail ran near Yapachi Pueblo, an unexcavated site, and Stone Lion Shrine, a circle of boulders surrounding two carved lions. Modern Pueblos still use it occasionally. Because the stones form a circle, I couldn't help but think of a miniature Stonehenge. Shortly after passing Stone Lion Shrine on the way back to our site, we looked up to see a massive satellite dish in the distance. According to the map, it's on the property of the Los Alamos National Laboratory. The juxtaposition of the ancient and modern reminded me again of New Mexico's extremes. For the people who lived in Yapachi, news traveled as fast as their fastest runner. Today, that satellite could send news into space around the world and back in a blink. If Stone Lion Shrine left Andy and me curious about its origin, what would the ancestral Pueblos think of that dish? Not to mention the defense drama, high-tech hijinks, sophisticated supercomputing, and who knows what else that goes on at the Los Alamos lab in the desolate desert today. We arrived back on our lip of the Alamo in time to watch the sunset. We ate dinner with our feet dangling on the edge and sweat drying on our backs. I use quote marks because we had hiked for 8 hours and gained more than 2,500 feet in elevation. I craved a meal that would reward that, and I didn't get it. I longed for a meal like the one we had had two nights earlier at Santa Fe's Luminaria, the restaurant at Hotel Loreto. The tres leches with sweet contro, soaked elderflower, macerated berries was so surprising, so perfect in execution, so full in words I didn't know. I laughed with delight after one bite. It tasted like I feel when I see my old high school friends. When I called home, I almost didn't tell my wife about it for fear of inadequately describing it. The freeze-dried meal I ate atop Alamo Canyon was extreme in the other direction, but the view and the silence made up for it. I was barefoot with my boots on, straddling the deep past of the shrine and the deep future of the satellite dish. The sky became orange and then purple, and finally black. I had nowhere to be and no time to be there. So I sat and watched it change.
Here's another article from True West Magazine on Billy the Kid. Special Classic Gunfights, Shootout at Stinking Springs by Bob Bowes Bell. December 23rd, 1880. Riding at midnight through deep snow, Sheriff-elect Pat Garrett leads a 13-man posse eastward out of Fort Sumner, New Mexico. After questioning several people in Fort Sumner and ascertaining the kid's dress, especially his hat, which is said to be a Mexican sugar loaf with a green hat band, Garrett decides he won't take any chances. When the kid makes his appearance, Garrett will kill him and hope the rest surrender. After a 10-mile ride to the Brazil Wilcox Ranch, where Billy the Kid and his compadres were last seen, Garrett picks up their trail clearly in the snow. Following this trail, a short distance, he recounts, I am convinced that they made for Stinking Springs. A half mile away from the house, Garrett and his men hold a conference. Around 3 a.m., with Juan Robel left in charge of the horses, Garrett divides his squad and circles the house with half the force, finding a dry arroyo fairly close to the house. The men dig in. Frank Stewart and the rest of the posse conceal themselves about 200 yards from the other side of the building. They see three horses tied to the vigas, roof beams sticking out of the wall, outside the stone house, and conclude that two mounts must be inside with the outlaws. Garrett sends a message to Stewart of their plan of attack. Stealthily enter the house, cover them with our guns, and hold them until daylight. Lee Hall favors the suggestion. Stewart does not. Garrett is overruled. The men shiver and attempt to stay warm until daylight, about a four-hour wait. It's so cold, posse member Charlie Rudolph gets frostbite on his feet. As the posse members wait, they hear snoring from inside the rock house. The hours drag by, and the temperature seems to get colder as the men look for any sign of movement from the inmates. The lanky sheriff commands a direct view of the doorway. While waiting for the kid's sombrero to pop into view, Garrett orders his men, "When I bring up my gun, you raise and fire." As the weak rays of sunlight began streaking the horizon, the posse hears movement in the house. Shortly, a man appears in the doorway with a nose bag, feed bag for the horses. The man's head is down, but Garrett sees a Mexican hat with a green band and brings his Winchester rifle to his shoulder. Seven bullets rip through the pale dawn light. The man reels into the house, and the horses pull at their tethers. The inmates inside are now awake, trying to avoid the trampling hooves of their four-legged bunkmates. Billy Wilson's voice is heard. Bowdry is killed and wants to come out. Garrett yells for them to come out with his hands up. As Charlie Bowdry staggers to the door, the kid catches hold of his belt, draws his revolver, around in front of Bowdry and says, "They have murdered you, Charlie, but you can get revenge. Kill some of those sons of bitches before you die." Bowdry comes out with his hands barely up. He stumbles toward the posse until he recognizes Garrett, and he goes straight at him. Motioning with his hands at the house and strangling in his own blood, he gasps, I wish, then with a whisper, "I'm dying," he falls into Garrett's arms. The lawman gently lays him on his blankets. As the morning light brightens, Garrett notices the rope ties on one of the outside horses is moving. He quickly surmises that the outlaws are trying to bring the horses inside in order to make a break. Garrett shoots the horse dead and it drops in the doorway. To stop any more attempts, Garrett takes careful aim and shoots the ropes of the other horses. The animals walk away and are captured by Stewart's men. Garrett opens up a conversation with the inmates, and the kid answers as their spokesman. Garrett asks how he is fixed in there. "Pretty well," the kid coolly answers, "but we have no wood to get breakfast." "Come out," Garrett says, "and get some. Be a little sociable." "Can't do it, Pat," the kid replies. Business is too confining. No time to run around. Garrett decides to eat breakfast, so he goes with half the men back 3 miles to the Brazil Wilcox Ranch headquarters. After the meal, Garrett makes arrangements with Thomas Wilcox to deliver food for the men, forage for the horses, and wood. As the wagon is being loaded, Garrett returns to Stinking Springs and relieves Stuart, who gathers up his men to go to breakfast. Garrett then invites the kid out for coffee. "Go to hell, Pat," says the kid, obviously losing a bit of his jolly humor. Soon, the posse members on the east side begin to hear sounds of picking. Evidently, the outlaws are trying to break out or at least make firing ports. Garrett sends Tom Emery and James East to stop it. A few well-aimed shots end the picking, but the horses get scared and are about to run over Billy and his men. Billy later tells a reporter, "If it hadn't have been for the dead horse in the doorway, I wouldn't have been captured. But I couldn't ride out over that, for my horse would have jumped back and I would have got it in the head." At about 3 p.m., the kid turns loose the two horses he's holding inside, and the posse picks them up. At 4 p.m., the Wilcox wagon arrives, and the men build a big fire and go to cooking. The smell of roasting meat is too much for the outlaws. Dirty Dave Rudabach sticks a handkerchief that had once been white on the end of a stick and calls out for a surrender. Garrett tells them to come out with their hands up, but only Dirty Dave leaves the house to talk with him. The outlaws want a guarantee of protection from violence. Garrett agrees, and Dirty Dave returns to the house. After a few minutes, all four outlaws come out with their hands raised. The kid is the last. According to legend, before the kid steps out, he urinates on the weapons. As the inmates approach the posse, Barney Mason levels his rifle at the kid and spits out, "Kill the son of a bitch. He's slippery and may get away." Posse members Tom Emery and Jim East are appalled at Mason's treachery and aim their Winchesters at Garrett's friend. One of them says, "If you fire a shot, we'll kill you." Mason backs off. After the kid and his men are disarmed, the outlaws shake hands with every man who captured them. The prisoners are taken to the Brazil Wilcox Ranch, where Mrs. Wilcox feeds the whole lot. Garrett sends a wagon back to retrieve Bowdry's body, and everyone stays overnight at the ranch. A long, slow slog. The next day is Christmas Eve, and by noon, the lawmen and their prisoners reach Fort Sumner, where they headquarter at Beaver Smith's saloon and eat lunch while the prisoners are shackled together. In the afternoon, Garrett leads his men and a wagon full of prisoners towards Las Vegas in deep snow. They have Christmas dinner at Padre Polacco's store in Puerto de Luna. And then after the wagon axle breaks, the posse travels all night and arrives in Las Vegas by late morning on December 26th. As Garrett gets ready to leave for Santa Fe on a train, a mob meets them at the station. They want Dirty Dave Rudabaugh. The standoff lasts for an hour. Train interview. A mob met Garrett and his posse and prisoners at the train station. As Garrett successfully stood off the mob, Billy casually talked to a reporter for the Las Vegas Gazette. "We saw him again at the depot when the crowd presented a really warlike appearance. Standing by the car, out of one of the windows of which he was leaning, he talked freely with us of the whole affair. I don't blame you for writing of me as you have. You had to believe other stories. But then I don't know as anyone would believe anything good of me anyway," he said. "I wasn't the leader of any gang. I was for Billy all the time. About the Portales business, I owned the rancho with Charlie Bowdry. I took it up and was holding it because I wanted to keep it for a station. but I found there were certain men who wouldn't let me live in the country. And so I was going to leave. We had all our grub in the house when they took us in, and we were going to a place about 6 miles away in the morning to cook it and then light out. I haven't stolen any stock. I made my living by gambling, but that was the only way I could live. They wouldn't let me settle down. If they had, I wouldn't be here today. And he held up his right arm, on which was the bracelet. Chisholm got me into all this trouble and then wouldn't help me out. If it hadn't been for the dead horse in the doorway at Stinking Springs, I wouldn't be here. I would have ridden my bay mare and taken my chances of escaping, said he. But I couldn't ride out over that, for she would have jumped back and I would have got it in the head. We could have stayed in the house, but there wouldn't have been anything gained by that, for they would have starved us out. I thought it was better to come out and get a good square meal, don't you? The prospects of a fight exhilarated him, and he bitterly bemoaned being chained. If I only had my Winchester, I'd lick the whole crowd, was his confident comment on the strength of the attacking party. He sighed and sighed again for a chance to take a hand in the fight, and the burden of his desire was to be set free to fight on the side of his captors as soon as he should smell powder. As the train rolled out, he lifted his hat and invited us to call and see him in Santa Fe, calling out, "Adios." Billy delivered. December 27, 1880. The mob wants Dirty Dave Radabaugh. He killed jailer Lino Valdez during an unsuccessful bid to free crony J.J. Webb in April. Garrett promised Dave at Stinking Springs he would take him to Santa Fe. The standoff lasts for half an hour, then an associate of Garrett's runs up to the engine and opens the throttle. The huge steam engine spins in its tracks for several seconds, then rockets past the platform and leaves the angry mob behind. It is Billy's first ride on a train. He is as excited as a kid can be. The posse men have been on the trail for weeks, sleeping in the same clothes, riding in the bitter cold. They look every bit as rough as the men they have captured. To the other passengers, there is no discernible difference between captive and captor. Due to heavy snowfall, the train stalls at Glorieta Pass for several hours. Billy amuses the boys by ordering a piece of apple pie and placing the entire slice in his mouth. He opens his mouth and, ta-da, it's still in one piece. As Garrett and his posse yuck it up over this hilarious entertainment, one thing is obvious to the conductor. These boys need to get out more. Garrett deposits his prisoners with Sheriff Sherman in Santa Fe. There is a small snafu when Garrett orders food for the prisoners, and the jailer eats it all.